The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. And for the next hour, or half hour, I should say, I'm going to be reading to you from National Geographic. But before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we're going to be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Today on Armchair Traveler, writer Nina Strokolik visits three struggling countries where people's stories are at risk, but there are those trying to save them. Now, her article, Rescuing History, appeared in the June 2024 issue of National Geographic, and we begin first with an introduction. Sadiq Salih had a favor to ask. It was dusk, and we were standing in his family's small orchard on the outskirts of Soleimani, a city known as the cultural capital of Iraqi Kurdistan. I'd been granted a meeting later that night with a secretive elder sheikh, rumored to possess one of the finest collections of Kurdish manuscripts. Sadiq, a mild-mannered 65-year-old with a permanent smile, now looks serious. Ask him, "You have collected so many manuscripts, why not give some to Zihin?" Well, Zihin, which means life in Kurdish, is the name of an archive that Sadiq and his brother Rafiq have spent more than two decades building, an assemblage of books, manuscripts, newspapers, letters, diaries, and other documents dating back to the 19th century. It presents the twisting saga of the Kurds, often described as one of the world's largest ethnic groups without a state. Collecting these artifacts is a calling that has taken the brothers across parts of Turkey, Iran, Syria, and Iraq that composed Greater Kurdistan, a mountainous region where up to 35 million people of different religions and customs identified themselves as Kurdish. The Kurds' story zigzags from life in the mountains overlooking Mesopotamia to medieval conquest led by the famous warrior Saladin, to betrayal after World War I when the Allied powers denied them a state of their own, to the bloody campaign in 1988 by then-President Saddam Hussein to wipe them out in Iraq. It's a history that has made them cautious and distrustful. It has infused the Salih brothers with a sense of mission. The Kurds may be without a state, but if Sadiq and Rafiq persevere, their people won't be without a richly documented story. As we lingered in the cold night air, I was surprised by Sadiq's request. He and Sheikh Mohammed Ali Khorijani had known each other for more than 20 years. He explained that the sheikh never allowed anyone to see his full collection. It was said to hold hundreds of documents spanning 400 years, and Sadiq was fixated on what it might contain. A diary recording critical political events, a lost masterpiece of poetry, a secret diplomatic letter. Well, in the business of archiving, every lead offers the tantalizing promise of a fresh piece of the collective story. And the Kurd story, Sadiq said, had been suppressed for generations. "This work we do is a war, a very peaceful war," he told me. "Please ask him." Like a detective, an archivist collects evidence to create a full picture of events. Imagine trying to tell the history of the United States from only the British point of view. And think how our understanding of history would change if Abraham Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, the writings of Che Guevara, or the speeches of Nelson Mandela had been lost. The story gains context and nuance with each infusion from its myriad communities. The creation stories of the first Australians, the paintings of Frida Kahlo, and the music of Aretha Franklin. Most developed countries have sprawling, well-funded repositories. And by the way, the reference to Frida Kahlo, she was a Mexican painter, by the way. Even small developing nations such as Guinea-Bissau and Palau maintain modest national archives. But what about groups like the Kurds who fall between the cracks of officially recognized nations, people living in places shattered by conflict, whose culture and history are excluded from the prevailing narrative? What about them? Well, their history often ends up shoved into bags and boxes and tucked away in attics. My grandparents fled Poland after the Holocaust, and growing up, I'd marveled at the line on their visa application where a U.S. immigration official had marked their nationality as without. The only documented evidence of their lives as Jews in Poland and our family's centuries in Europe was a clutch of documents we kept in a yellow suitcase, a temporary Polish passport, identity cards from the concentration camps, a handful of photographs. For years, I've searched for the ways stateless people seek to reclaim their stories after displacement and destruction. In the young nation of South Sudan, I followed archivists who had gathered rotting documents from basements in an attempt to build a national identity. In refugee camps and on migrant trails, I asked the displaced what they'd bought from home. For many, these items are a means of maintaining their identity when officially they may not have had one. And sometimes, everyday civilians under extraordinary conditions risk their lives to save them. In Kurdistan, Kosovo, and Somaliland, regions still struggling for their nationhood, I found these people. The stories they are holding close or attempting to piece back together are not static, said Ann Gilliland, a professor at UCLA who studies the role of archives in memory in war zones, frozen conflicts, and unrecognized states. They're alive, and in war they're often targets. Obliterating a record is a way of obliterating people, Gilliland told me. That puts the people who saved them on the front lines of a quiet but crucial battle over history and memory. And now we're going to begin in three parts with part one, looking at Kurdistan. Wearing a long white robe and prayer cap, Sheikh Mohammed Ali Karajani ushered me into his home in a well-to-do Soleimani neighborhood. He fingered a string of amber prayer beads as he described his more than 20 years as a consultant for the Iraqi House of Manuscripts in Baghdad. During those years, he'd learned of historical Kurdish documents held by antique dealers and private estates. He began to buy them for himself, ensuring they wouldn't be lost or taken out of the country. Later, Saddam's regime jailed him as a Kurdish activist, using his collection as evidence of his guilt. As Sadiq had predicted, the Sheikh was reluctant to say how many manuscripts he had. He agreed to show me just one book. It was a handmade brown cover and filled with pages of handwritten Kurdish script and colorful flourishes. It's a kashkul, he said, describing a scrapbook of favorite poems, scriptures, and vignettes from Kurdish literature. This one had belonged to a Kurdish writer centuries ago. In other kashkuls, the sheikh found unpublished poems from Nali and Salim, beloved Kurdish poets. I took this moment to pose Sadiq's question. Why not donate some of his collection to Zaheen? The sheikh was known to be a generous with scholars, often lending manuscripts to be studied and copied, but the originals lived with him. Shouldn't his unique book be in a Kurdish national archive? His son, Amjad, spoke up. We want a national archive to be under government authority, not a party, not a person. Once that's in place, he'd be happy to give his collection, he said. Later, when I relayed the sheikh's answer, Sadiq wasn't surprised. Persuading scholars to part with their collections has been difficult, in part because Sadiq isn't a professional historian. He's a retired geologist. He launched Zaheen as a project after U.S.-led coalition forces halted Saddam's crackdown on the Kurds in 1991. As an autonomous Kurdish government without Iraq, Sadiq began to feel that while the Kurds were no longer at risk of being erased, their history was. In the late 1990s, he and his brother started collecting books written by Kurdish historians and literary figures. They tracked down old issues of Kurdish periodicals, including the edition of Zaheen, an early Kurdish language magazine, published from 1918 to 1919, and the name they took for the project. Because Kurds weren't independent, other people wrote their history for them, Sadiq said, referring to Ottoman, British, and Iraqi chronicles. The Kurdish voice is missing. That's what we're looking for, he said. Eventually, the local government donated a four-story building in downtown Soleimani. The regional government provides funding for 14 staff members and small salaries. Among treasures on Sahin's shelves are 1,300 original manuscripts and hundreds of rare books, including a later copy of the first known book published about Kurdish history, Sharafanama, written in Persian in 1597. Now, over time, Sahin has dedicated rooms to the private collections of various intellectuals and politicians and digitized documents from the British colonial period. To date, it has amassed an archive containing more than 72,000 books and nearly 2,000 Kurdish magazines and newspapers, thousands of photographs and hours of audio and video recordings, and they're continually searching for more. They appeal to the families of historical figures and scour markets on the Internet. One September morning, I accompanied Sadiq to meet the daughter of Rafiq Hilmi, a Kurdish historian, poet, and political activist who served as a translator for British colonial leaders during the early 20th century. At a well-appointed home, she greeted us wearing all black, her white hair pinned against an elegant loop against the nape of her neck. Sadiq introduced us and told me her name, ironically, was Sahin. The name is the archive. "We named ourselves after you," he teased her. Sheena Abdullah, an anthropologist who works at the Kurdistan Institution in Soleimani, accompanied us. 4 years ago, she and Sadiq had come to discuss acquiring Sahin's father's papers, and Sheena noticed other boxes tucked into a corner. Their contents sketched the remarkable life of Sahin's older sister, Nahida, a trailblazing world traveler and writer who had died a few years earlier. Soon, Sheena was immersed in Nahida's world. Handwritten letters and diaries detailed her love life. Newspaper clippings announced her arrival at Clark University in Massachusetts in 1949, and postcards told of friendships from Oregon to Damascus. Though Nahida hadn't studied anthropology, she wrote prolifically about the food, language, and customs of every place she visited. Never had Sheena read such a detailed account from a Kurdish woman's perspective. This archive told a story few people knew. Sadiq agreed, and Nahida's collection became the first woman's library added to the Sahin archive. In the doorway to the Sahin Hilmi's home, Sheena kissed the older woman's cheeks and squeezed her hands. We were led into a living room and sat under a wall covered with black and white family portraits. Sahin has no children, and these visits were welcome company. She ferried platters of flatbread, truffles, and dainty walnut pastries from the kitchen as Sadiq repeated a question he'd asked Sahin many times. Is there anything else she might consider donating? At first, Sahin claimed there was nothing left. Sadiq politely pressed the question. It was a familiar dance between them. Finally, much poking around in boxes and bookshelves in the upstairs bedrooms, unearthed two new treasures, a marbled notebook filled with her father's handwritten account of the British Empire's rule, and a small black diary of Nahida's. As an anthropologist, Sheena had grown convinced of the heritage they'd gathered was not just for Kurdistan. It was to draw out the similarities of a global citizenry, to tie a connective string between an Amazonian tribe who sang songs on the hunt and a Kurdish farmer who hummed melodies as he sowed his fields, or perhaps to show how women's contributions to history had been hidden in diaries and letters in Kurdistan and Uganda and the Soviet Union. These records are not just ours, she said. They're the world's. And that brings us to part two, Somaliland. After the sunset prayer on an evening in May, when everyone else had gone, Hafsa Omer placed three cassette tapes on her desk. Her office occupied one side of a small building on the grounds of the Hargeisa Cultural Center in the capital of Somaliland, which has existed as a self-declared republic since breaking away from Somalia in 1991. Once the region was called the Land of the Bards, and its capital was known as the Home of Literature. With the war's end, little evidence of that heritage remained. But now it was quiet. Hafsa liked to work late so she could listen to the cassette tapes cluttering her desk without bothering her colleagues. Her job was to study the handwritten labels, decipher lyrics distorted by crackles and clicks, and determine which old songs, poems, or plays they held. She started interning at the center after high school and now worked full-time archiving the thousands of tapes lining the walls. They offered a soundscape of a nation she never knew when plays premiered at the National Theater. Music shops blasted their offerings on every corner, and poets recited verse that criticized the government. Every time she popped one of the cassettes into the player, a surprise awaited. Tonight she hit play and outpoured a flood of salutations announced in the old style. "I'm sending you a greeting wider than the ocean and sweeter than honey," it began, "a greeting that comes from the bottom of my heart, a greeting of siblings, the most graceful greeting that someone can send to someone else. I'm greeting you with flowers and wet leaves." Before it ended, Hafsa began to cry. Somaliland's current borders are based on an 1800s colonial division which separated British protectorate from Italian Somaliland. In 1960, the former colonies merged, creating the Somali Republic, but a secession movement brewed in what has been British Somaliland. In the 1980s, war erupted, and President Mohamed Siad Barre's government on the south launched a genocidal campaign against the Isaac clan, Somali's majority ethnic group. Somalis often say their history was rarely written down. As far back as anyone can trace, Somalis have practiced an oral culture, and the traditions of live storytelling, singing, and reciting drama and poetry have remained a bedrock of their identity. The rise of cheap tape recorders made the cassette a ubiquitous part of Somali culture, and the 1970s and 80s became a golden era for Somali music. By chance, I heard about an album containing songs from that era, sweet as broken dates, lost Somali tapes from the Horn of Africa. The producer told me that as civil war ravaged towns and cities, Somalis saved their precious recordings by hiding them, burying them, or smuggling them out of the country. This led me to the Hargeisa Cultural Center, founded by Jama Mus Jama, a mathematician who'd been living in Italy since the war. When Jama returned home, he marveled at the capital's new buildings, but he also knew that not one was reserved for the arts. "We built beautiful structures, but we didn't heal our young people from the trauma we passed on," he told me. "We didn't give them something they'd feel proud of." So in 2014, he founded the Center for the Young Somalis to learn about their heritage. And the way to reach their souls, Jama reasoned, was through their ears. He purchased a trove of 3,568 cassettes from a defunct music studio. In London, a scholar provided 70 recordings of poetry recited by members of the Somaliland's nomadic desert tribes. Jama also received other collections that had been abandoned by their owners or tucked into bags as families fled the fighting. Soon 10,000 more cassettes filled a storage room in his home. He hoped these tapes would build a bridge to the past, revealing vibrant Somali culture that younger generations would learn from and take pride in. Hafsa, born in 2002, had no memory of a culturally flourishing Somaliland. After the war, an imported stricter from form of Islam took hold. Even her mother scolded her for listening to music instead of the Quran. But at the cultural center, Hafsa entered a different world as she logged freshly digitized tapes, researching their contents and indexing the hundreds of singers, poets, composers, and religious scholars. She noted the song's themes, love, lament, debate, patriotism, Dagajilan, tunes that encouraged people to fight against oppression. The music of her generation lusted after girls and new cars, but in the old songs she heard stories of love that bloomed during wartime. Occasionally she'd insert a cassette and a message would play. These letter tapes had come from across the world, Djibouti, Kenya, Italy, and Dubai, everywhere the Somali diaspora had fled. One night, Hafsa's brother went to the cupboard where he kept the family's passports and retrieved three cassettes to add to the archive. Two contained love songs. The third, recorded on January 25, 1985, was the one that made her cry. The raspy voice belonged to her beloved Aunt Kajaja. It sent news to a brother in Dubai. One brother's farms were doing well, another's business went bankrupt, another had welcomed a new son, two sisters had gotten divorced. In the background, a baby cried. The tape continued. War seemed imminent. Government soldiers had arrived in their village and forced them to move, even taking their food. What can we do? Kajaja said. We didn't know why we have this curse. In turn, her sisters and nieces offered their wishes and news, often chastising the brother for not sending updates. Why didn't you send us any cassette tapes? One niece pleaded. They'd give the tape to a neighbor, a policeman, who'd make sure it reached Dubai, another sister said. Then Khadija returned. You can't listen to our voices, and we can be your you can listen, rather, to our voices, and you can be our company, she said. Khadija died suddenly in 2019, but hearing the familiar voice made Hafsa feel as though her aunt was still with her. She set the tape aside to add to the archive. It belonged with the other voices that told the history of their new nation. In part three, the final part of our article, is about Kosovo. It was a hot June day in 1999 when Nehat Krasnici returned to Kosovo's National Library in Pristina. The first things he noticed were the dirty clothes, beer bottles, and military maps that littered the reading rooms. In one of the last chapters of Yugoslavia's civil war, the Serbian military, backing Kosovo's ethnic Serbs, attacked ethnic Albanians, attempting to create an independent nation. Roughly 13,500 people were dead or missing, the vast majority of them ethnic Albanians. Now the fighting had stopped, and the people, like Krasniqi, were picking up the shattered pieces. Over the past decade, the National Library's distinctive downtown building, famous for its 99 domes, had at various times been inhabited by refugees and soldiers. As Krasniqi toured the rooms, he had only one question. Did the papers he'd once dedicated his life to saving survive Kosovo's war? Like all students in Kosovo, Krasniqi had learned about the Roman and Ottoman empires of the region, followed by the socialist rule of Josip Broz Tito's Yugoslavia. But during his doctoral research, Krasniqi was surprised to stumble upon numerous manuscripts describing the history from the perspective of Albanian Kosovars, not their conquerors. These finds, he felt, were proof of a thriving intellectual past and the deep roots of Albanian language and culture. It was a story that didn't appear in Tito's authorized history. As a specialist for the National Library, Krasniqi began traveling the country, gathering manuscripts that reflected this Kosovar identity. In towns that had been Ottoman trading posts, he found documents stuffed into attics and basements coated with mouse droppings and cobwebs. He unearthed poetry and prose written by local authors in Ottoman, Turkish, Arabic, and Persian. Once a young woman opened a yogurt container to reveal a 17th century copy of Cuneus Profetarum, a Catholic catechism that was among the first books written and printed in the Albanian language. With hundreds of newly found manuscripts, he established a special collection at the National Library and set about translating and cataloging them. But in 1989, when Serbian President Slobodan Milosevic invoked martial law, ethnic Albanians were dismissed from the state jobs. Police arrived at the National Library and ordered Krasniqi to train his Serbian replacement. 10 years later, after a NATO intervention ended the war, Krasniqi finally returned to the garbage-strewn library. He discovered that nearly all of the Albanian language books had been sent to pulping mills, but in his former office he found his manuscripts in cardboard boxes. They'd been damaged by sun and water, but they'd survived. Milosevic wanted to erase huge chunks of our history, Krasniqi told me, because that's how you can make a nation submissive and keep it enslaved. Knowing your history is a fuel for freedom. Determined to find what pieces of Kosovo's past survive, Krasniqi drove through the charred landscape. Homes and mosques lay in ruins, and the stench of corpses emanated from wells. Old documents were a low priority as people mourned the dead and tried to rebuild. But at each house, Krasniqi made the same plea. If you have any old books or manuscripts, let the National Library buy them. When I visited him in Pristina, Krasniqi, now 65, had retired from the library. Over espresso in a downtown cafe, he described his years ferreting out manuscripts after the war. There was one place he couldn't bear to return to. The city of Jakova had known had a renowned Teki, or Sufi, temple, which was believed to be the birthplace of nationalism, Albanian nationalism, shaped by three brothers who revolutionized Albanian education, literature, and ideology in the 19th century. The Bekashi Teki had served as a center of political activism and religious study. When Grashniki visited before the war, he'd been awestruck by the ornately illustrated manuscripts, collections of poetry, and the hundreds of codices and topics such as astronomy and medicine handwritten by revered scholars. One of the library's prized possessions was a copy of poems written by Shams e-Tabrizi, the spiritual guide of the 13th century poet Rumi, translated into Albanian. These were some of the rarest documents Grashniki had ever seen. Because the dervishes were so secretive, few of the holdings had been studied. There were manuscripts you couldn't even measure in gold, he recalled. And during the war, the Teki was burned, its library reduced to ash. It was, Grashniki believes, one of Kosovo's greatest cultural losses. He had been too devastated to return, but now he offered to take me there to help me understand the destruction. A week later, as we stood in the arched entryway of a stucco building, a tall man with a flowing gray beard led us inside the rebuilt Bistaki Teki. Uraf Rodanici was a longtime Sufi dervish who served the order. He pointed out photos that showed the Teki's skeletal post-war remains. He learned it had been burned, he said, when he was living in a refugee camp in Albania in 1999. He'd wept so violently that people assumed his family had been killed. Grashniki brought up the precious manuscripts. Had they all been destroyed? Yes, Rodanici said with his hand over his heart. That knowledge is lost forever. He led us to a small office, and Grashniki sighed as he scanned the modest collection of modern books. Then something caught his eye. Near the floor, a small stack of paper leaned against a bundle of leather-bound volumes. He gently lifted a page and inspected it closely. "This is very interesting, actually," he said. "It was a handwritten copy of the first prayer in the Quran. Its curled lettering was a rare example of one of Kosovo's most beautiful styles of religious calligraphy." These were donations, the dervish explained. After the war, he pleaded with the community to rebuild the Teki's library with whatever they could find. With reading glasses perched on his nose, Grashniki crouched to examine a tiny handwritten prayer book from the 1816. "This might be valuable," he said, passing it to the stunned dervish. He made a pile, praying Ottoman tax records, religious scripture, personal letters. Sweat beaded on Krasniki's brow as he scanned the shelves. This was how he'd spent much of his career, looking for lost treasure. He pulled out two small books with elaborate designs. They'd been preserved. If they'd been preserved, they couldn't have been of huge artistic value, he said. Still, they were important enough to be kept inside. And then we went downstairs for coffee, and Grashniki seemed revived by the joys of discovering something new. For decades, he had fought against the ravages of time and conflict, politics, ignorance, and even the indifference of his own country. But there were still jewels of history to be found and people who would cherish them. A sign for the towering gray and white apartment buildings boasted of a better lifestyle. Around us, young people smoked hookahs and scrolled through Instagram. In comparison to Deke, a man and his colleagues nicknamed the Encyclopedia, might seem like a relic, someone unearthing a bitter past while his nation tries to move on. And we'll stop there. That was quite a story, wasn't it, about those different cultures and trying to reclaim their history. And that, my friends, brings us to the end of today's episode of Armchair Traveler. I hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be with us again next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, reminding you the content of the program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Now, Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That website address again is ncreadingservice.org. Comments and questions may be directed to 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.